Simon, welcome to the Freedom Footprint Show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Simon, the first time I met you was at Baltic Honey Badger in Riga back in 2019. You remember that?
Right. I do remember.
Yeah. Where a fascinating time. And since then, you've become a titan in the blockchain studying department, I guess, or the time chain studies department of the Academy of Bitcoin. And since you sort of invented mempool space, or at least co-invented it, I guess.
Right.
Can you give our listeners the TLDR on you, so I don't misrepresent you too much here?
Sure. So the TLDR is that I started deep into Bitcoin in 2017, right in the bull run, block size war and all that. And I was also traveling everywhere, just living a nomadic lifestyle. So that's why I had the opportunity to go to like all these conferences, like Honey Badger in 2019. And I went to a bunch of other ones, like Building on Bitcoin in Lisbon. And it was in late 2018 that I created mempool.space, the first version. And I think 2020, me and Wiz like made it into a company, and we hired like a team of great developers that together we've been building it out to what it is today, which is like a fully featured like block explorer with tons of features. We had Lightning Explorer and like an audit system. I mean, there's so much stuff we've been able to do the past few years. So I guess that's the TLDR.
It's become the industry standard for fee estimation and a lot of other things. And for like most wallets, when you click open in external explorer kind button, and then they redirect you to mempool.space because it's the most trustworthy one, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, it's quite incredible. I wouldn't have imagined when I made the website, because for me it was just a small tool to track transactions, like to see where your transactions are in the mempool. That was like the original idea. Like, which block are you in? Are you in the next block or the next block? So, I mean, that's the core of the website, right? So,
yeah, it sort of emerged, like Bitcoin emerged. It emerged out of a simple set of simpler things. So yeah, there are three things I really want to talk to you about today. And one is the fees. And I know you're a proponent of higher fees, or maybe that's a bit misrepresentation as well. So let's go into that whole category. And of course, the spam and what to do about it and how to categorize it and what's good and what's bad, and straighten up a couple of things around that and about how the mempool works in general, and what data you can extract out of mempool.space. I'm realizing that this is more than three things. And then the final thing is that you read Bitcoin Judas's book, so we don't have to. Yeah. And that was, yes, you took one for the team there, having to endure that, I guess. We can go into that and point out why that whole thing is wrong. Yeah. So where do you want to start?
We can start with the fee market stuff.
Yeah, what is going on? The fees are right now estimated in the next block to be around 180 sats per V-byte. Why is that?
It looks like, I mean, if you go to mempool.space, we have a new filter on the main page, like the dashboard. You can see the next block, and you can filter by coin join and consolidation transactions and data. So if you click the data, you'll see that right now the majority of the transactions seems to be like data stuff, which is mostly like JPEGs and tokens and token transfers. So I think that's the cause of many of the fee spikes like the past year, I'd say. Because if you discount for all the data fee spikes, there hasn't been that much activity in the mempool so far, this year at least.
And I think this data tab used to be a fecal matter icon.
Yeah, it was like for one day, and then we changed to a more general purpose data. So the data includes various kinds of data inclusion. So it's both the inscription type when you add data in the witness data in transactions, and it also includes the op return data, which is a field in transaction output where you can embed a certain amount of data. So there's also a third category, which is fake pub keys, which is used by a legacy way of doing multisig before we had PageScript hash. So that's also a way that people found to include data on the blockchain. So those bound together forms the data category we have. So you can see what's data. And then you can call it data, you can call it spam. Depends on your kind of view. So it's a big hot debate right now, and it's been going on for a year from when the whole ordinal stuff started.
Yeah, and I guess you may or may not be under pressure from certain groups to remove the fecal matter icon, I guess. I don't know what you can say and about your opinions on this stuff, but what's the difference between the different types of data? Is there a reason that you remove the emoji? Is some data less this?
Yeah, I think it's, we have some kind of guidelines and visions when we do decisions on what we add on the website. And like, are we going to add JPEGs and you can view JPEG, or are we going to add this or that? I mean, we have some guidelines, right? And like one guideline is no shitcoin, for example. So we won't add any support for the tokens or stuff like that. But we also have a very neutral view to the blockchain. Like, we don't want to take any too much of a opinion on what this is. So like the shitcoin emoji that we had for, I think, one day before we removed it to change the data is just because that reason. It just became too much drama very quickly, because people start arguing about it very quickly. But change the data and everyone is pleased, because everyone can decide what this is. It is embedded data. Like, the more objective, if you get what I mean. So we're not trying to decide for the users what this is. We let the user decide. We just want to show what's on the blockchain, what's in the mempool, and just be a tool a general tool that show unbiased data, basically.
Yeah, that's a noble stance indeed, to keep it apolitical. I like that, and step aside, remove yourself from the drama of Bitcoin Twitter. We here on the show, we've definitely taken a stance on this, and like in my view and in Luke's as well, I think we view the Satoshi as something very special, and these other any other arbitrary data you can put to the Satoshi, or rather to the transaction, is by definition less special than the Satoshi itself. So already there we find a problem with like attaching data to transactions.
Yeah, I think I have one very like personal opinion, my opinion is, and then I have my professional opinion, like what I'm putting into practice in the website. And in my personal stance is that I treat the block space as something very scarce, very unique. And I always, for all these years, I've been extremely cautious when I'm doing like UTXO management. I don't want to make too many transactions, because I know that all these extra transactions are going to be stored on the blockchain forever on everyone's node. So I'm not going to do like, oh, let's do some test transactions to see if it worked. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to make one transaction to reduce like spam on the blockchain. So, and then suddenly I see people just spamming hundreds, thousands of transactions that seem to me just meaningless in just data. It's a little bit sad. I don't think they really understand what they're doing. They don't really, I think these kind of people that do like the JPEGs and the tokens and stuff, they really don't really care about Bitcoin as a decentralized money. They just see it as some kind of a place you can gamble tokens and stuff like the DGEN things. So that's basically my opinion. I don't like it, but I also see it as inevitable. Like, it was inevitable that all the stuff, like when they were you know, before they tried to create new blockchains, a new fork of Bitcoin and try to scam people. Then it stopped working. Then it started creating like new words. It started creating ICO stuff, DeFi stuff, to scam people. Then they ran out of people to scam and they created the NFT stuff on Ethereum. And then people stopped buying the NFTs. So now they found like a new way. And the new way is to move everything on Bitcoin and call this, I'm building on Bitcoin, buy my shitcoin, right? And there's also a lot of new layer twos popping up. Recently, there's like, oh, we are a layer two on Bitcoin. I mean, you can do token trading and stuff. So there's a lot of stuff that a lot of Bitcoiners that are only into the sound money aspect don't like seeing. But again, I think it was inevitable because Bitcoin is like this one chain rule the whole world stuff. So eventually, like even according to that Bitcoin maximalist ideology, everything will be on Bitcoin, like eventually, right? So I've seen Bitcoin maximalists even claim that the Ordinals people and JPEG people, they're also Bitcoiners because they're building on Bitcoin. So why aren't they Bitcoiners as well? So
yeah, it's a delicate thing. And I when they were shitcoining on their own chains, at least they weren't clogging other people's nodes with bullshit. So they are using a flaw of the protocol to use people's storage space for their own interests. So they are risking sacrificing the golden goose for a Kinder egg, basically. That's the way I view it. nowadays. So it's bad behavior. I don't know how to fight it though, except for initiatives like ocean mining. I really like that, and we'll see how it works. I know there was another one, another similar. I don't remember the name of that, but I heard of it from that conference in Dubai. That there's another mining pool doing transparent mining.
Okay.
What are your thoughts on that?
I don't really see like how the way Ocean is doing it is actually doing any help, because the only thing happening is that another mining pool are going to mine the transactions. And we've seen recently that the more filters we put on the mempool, the more sideways people are finding to inject these weird transactions directly to the miners, like bypassing the mempool. So there was one mining pool who implemented like a whole product for this to inject, and it was all coming from the Ordinals ecosystem, like the demand for being able to inject special transactions straight into the block template, sidelining the mempool policy. So even if you have a strict mempool policy, I think one of the Luke Dash Jr.'s ideas is just a strict policy, but I think people will find a way around it. And also like the op return stuff, that the new token protocol that's going to be released soon called Runes, it's a way of storing data in op return. So that's something that's been in Bitcoin for a very long time, and I don't think it will change. So, I mean, I don't see any viable way of filtering that, for example. So I think it's inevitable. So that's why my conclusion to all this is that high fees fixes this, because they have to be priced out somehow. Because if you're doing a business of minting thousands of tokens every day, it's going to hurt when it costs like $10 per token. But if you have like a layer two network or some side chain or whatever, some other network you can do all this stuff on, I think it's inevitable that it will move to that network in the end. I don't know. It can take a while, but I think that's inevitable, because there's no reason why you should pay so much money. You're seeing that, like, I saw a website, you can see how much Bitcoin has been burned on just doing all this Ordinal stuff, and it's like hundreds of Bitcoin that's been burned. I would say burned, but by the people minting them. So I think I'm not too worried about the future of this. Actually, I think it's just going to be, the fees are going to go up, they're going to be priced out, and the hype is also going to go away. So like two things there. I think the hype is more short lived than people think. It could be like this bull cycle or something. It's going to be very popular to do these tokens, but after the next bear cycle, I think people are going to be fed up with buying these tokens because they're going to be worth less again, and then they're going to find something new.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you have to find new people to fool all the time, right? That's why they are able to do them in the first place, because you can't fool them with shitcoins anymore.
Yeah, there's something like that. I think I already seen a big drop in NFTs on Bitcoin and the BRC20 token trading. It was huge last year, the BRC20 tokens, but it seems that it has gone down massively already. So I some people are worried that this is here forever now and it's going to stay, but I'm not so sure. I think it's going to go away.
A self-solving problem. So when I look at the latest block here on mempool.space, I know this is just a snapshot, but about half the transactions are these data things. If I just look at it, maybe a little less than half. There's a great big one. Yeah.
There's been an increase the past weeks with all this stuff.
Yeah, and I remember the first time these came around and everyone was had their panties in an uproar, and it turned out that the problem went away within like less than 2 weeks, sort of. But the dangerous thing is like the stamps and all of this that are deliberately trying to destroy as much as possible, like and also we have experienced the base, like the lower band level sats per vbyte, like it never goes below a certain threshold now. It seems it has been above like 10 since for a month or something, and usually like the mempool clears every now and then, but we never have any, like, we can never be sure that we'll ever clear totally again, right?
Mm-hmm. It's a possibility we never will clear again. And it looked like when the fees started to go down and when it suddenly started to go down to 5, then all the JPEG people saw an opportunity to create a lot of images and stuff. So I think they take use of the low fees. So that's why low fees aren't that great.
So here, what do you think the higher fees go, what that will do for adoption, though? Because my view on this is that the high fees caused by all of this spam, it has got to be hurting right now new people entering into the space, because everything just costs more to do on Bitcoin now. And if high fees are the antidote to this, isn't that pricing out new adoption? What's your thought on that?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think we've seen fee spikes all the time in the past, I mean, 5-7 years. And what usually happens is that some use cases of Bitcoin is being priced out. So stuff that you could do before is no longer being done, or it's being shut down for some reason, like payments. Some companies that accept the Bitcoin for payments, I think in 2017, they stopped doing that. Was the on-chain fees were too high. But we also see, there's like so many, I think it's like 100-fold more people using Bitcoin today than 5 to 7 years ago, but the fees are still like quite low. So I think what's the reason for that is that the block space has been optimized so much, like the way people are using Bitcoin has been optimized. So when the fees are going up and well, we're having high fees, it's causing all the services that are using Bitcoin to optimize. I don't know if you remember, there was something called BitMEX o'clock. Like once a week at a certain clock, BitMEX did all their, I don't know, withdrawals or something. And the mempool would just be clogged like crazy for a whole day. But that doesn't happen anymore, because they are doing it in a much more efficient way now. They're spreading it out, or they are doing it in another way. And it was also very common, a lot of people have forgot this, but in before 2018, most exchanges, when you did a withdrawal, they did one transaction per withdrawal. So it was a big thing in 2018 and 19 when exchanges like Coinbase, Binance announced that we're doing batch withdrawals now. So we're doing like hundreds of withdrawals in one transaction, which is obviously much more efficient. So you've seen this like changes, and I'm probably going to mention this later, but this is the reason why big blocks is like extremely stupid, because it just makes people
lazy
and extremely wasteful. You're promoting wastefulness basically. But with the fees and the looming fees, everyone knows that the fees will go up and can go up. It causes all the infrastructure to adapt more, I say. But to go back to your question, there's certainly a lot of, when, if we're going to have like a period, like let's say we have a bull run this year and the fees are going to be $100 per transaction for like 6 months, it's going to be very tough for new people to like set up a Lightning wallet, for example. Like, even if you use a simple Lightning wallet, non-custodial like Phoenix, you still have to make an on-chain transaction. You maybe want to make one test transaction. You maybe want to transfer to a hardware wallet or something. It's going to cost a lot of money. So it might be a problem for adoption. And I really hope that it causes people to start looking into alternative methods. Like, for example, if the fees really go to like $100 per transaction this year or next year, I think more people would start considering using like Liquid sidechain, for example, for certain stuff. And I saw that, you know, people using HODL, the peer-to-peer exchange, that they might switch to using Liquid as well for trades. So instead of doing multiple on-chain transactions, every time you trade, you can do it. You can do one. You move some Bitcoin to Liquid that you plan on using for trading, and then you buy and sell on the Liquid network, for example. So I think the high fees is going to push this kind of change. But definitely, I mean, Bitcoin fees are going to go up because the block space is scarce, and you're probably going to compete with a lot of token trading, JPEG stuff as well. That's going to push the fees even higher. But this is like the one of the biggest issues of Bitcoin, and that's causing all of this debate and the forks and the split, is that Bitcoin can't really scale. Everyone can't just use Bitcoin on chain because we have a limit of, I think it's like 14 transactions per second, like if you averaged it out. So how would you make everyone use the on chain Bitcoin? You can't. So if you get a sustainable, if Bitcoin doesn't change at all from its current form, the fee is going to go very high if the adoption is very high. And you're mostly going to use Bitcoin on-chain transfers for larger transactions when it makes sense. But you're going to use small transactions maybe in a custodial Lightning wallet or sidechains like Liquid, or we invent new technologies. And this is the reason why I'm actually pro the Covenant soft fork, because it seems to open up for more alternative layer twos, alternative scaling solutions. I don't think that Lightning is solved like a silver bullet will solve everything. I think it's just one piece of the puzzle, but we need many stuff. I mean, we need a plethora of stuff that can be used for various reasons. Like you can use a Lightning wallet for doing small payments, your coffee payment. You can use Liquid for your trading, and you can use some other, I don't know, some layer two network that doesn't exist anymore for other stuff, and keep on-chain for like large value cold storage or something.
I love this perspective. I absolutely love it because like it hammers in the point that Bitcoin doesn't care about your opinions about it. It is here for you to study more than anything else. It is trying to teach you something about how it works. And that's always true. And the more you zoom out, the more you grasp of what it is doing. So like this narrative that dollar cost averaging was the best thing to do in the world, that is also sort of dying, since that requires a transaction every time you do it. And if you do a daily dollar cost averaging, it's probably not a good idea in a high fee environment, right? So correct me if I'm wrong. If I try to remember 2017, you say that Bitcoin, on-chain Bitcoin, has around 10 times more users today than it did back then, right? It's your
a rough estimate. I think so, because the adoption has skyrocketed. So many more people know about Bitcoin today than before. So I'm seeing, like, it feels like the user base has 10x'd, but the fees is still like the same, right?
Well, denominated in dollars, yes. but I think if I backtrack, like back in 2017, people weren't even using like fee estimators like Mempel's one. Like so it was vastly not under efficient, but vastly under efficient.
Right. It was extremely inefficient, everything, the fee estimations.
Yeah. So I think the whole thing that Mr. Veer was so upset about was like $20 fees for a short amount of times. But that must have been lower in terms, or way higher in terms of sats per V-byte, right? Since Bitcoin's purchasing power was lower.
If you go back to check a block, you see that the sats per V-byte is much more higher, I think. So in Satoshis, it's lower today, but in the dollar terms, it's about the same.
Yeah. So it is teaching us something, and that is how to use the time chain more efficiently, and the time space is limited.
Yeah,
fascinating stuff. So wait and see then is the answer, I guess.
Yeah, to the question of onboarding and scalability.
Yeah.
I think that's
the way to do it. Like, but Bitcoin doesn't need to scale to every person in the world. It just needs to scale to every dollar in the world, which is a different thing.
Yeah, that could be.
We're thrilled to introduce our new sponsor, the Bitbox 02 Bitcoin Only Edition.
Bitbox.
It's fully open source, Swiss engineered, and Bitcoin only forever. The device only supports Bitcoin, which means less code, less attack surface, and improved security for your Bitcoin. Check out the Bitbox 02 Bitcoin Only Edition at bitbox.swiss/freedom.
And use code. And use code freedom for. And use code freedom for 5% off.
Here's an idea for you. Come and see me and Luke in Prague, my favorite European city.
With over 100 world-class speakers and the chance to meet more than 100 leading Bitcoin companies, this is where ideas flourish, connections are made, and Bitcoin's path forward is forged together with 10,000 enthusiasts and professionals.
In Prague, people have been fighting for freedom since forever. So it's only natural that Prague is the Bitcoin capital of Europe. You should be there.
With 3 days of keynotes, panels, and side events, BTC Prague is the place to be for pure Bitcoin-only signal.
And the beer is just fantastic.
Use discount code FREEDOM for 10% off your ticket and another 5% discount if you pay with Bitcoin.
So remember, use code FREEDOM and see you in Prague.
Anyway, so one argument our Mr. Veer making in its fantastic book. So for those of you who don't know, there was a guy back in 2017 who let his ego get the better of him, and he wanted to increase the block size to a gazillion bytes per block, and he thought that would fix everything. And so, yeah, give us the TLDR on Roger Ver and his book, please, Simon.
Oh, where to start? I mean, after reading this book, there's almost nothing new for people that had been in Bitcoin since 17 and listened to at least one time what Roger Ver is saying in his debates and stuff. It's the same stuff all over again. And it's basically, he's part of like a small faction. I'm not sure if small is the right word, but there's a faction in Bitcoin that caused the whole community to split, that was super convinced that the way to scale Bitcoin was to just increase the block size. And if the fees go over, like, I even say he was shocked when the fees went to $1 per transaction. He thinks that's unacceptable. It has to be much cheaper than PayPal. So we should just increase the block size every time the fees go up. And we should just increase, because it doesn't matter. And it could be potentially several gigabytes per block, instead of like today's 2 megabytes. So that is the idea that this big blocker movement has been pushing. And but you said Roger Ver tried to change the block size, right? But it's deeper than this. It's about who is controlling Bitcoin, who has the power, who should dictate the rules of Bitcoin. This is what it's all about. It's only about control and power, right? And Roger Ver, if you look at his bio, he invested and bought Bitcoin.com, Blockchain.com. He's an investor in BitPay and other of these kind of companies. And all these companies had the agenda to increase the block size and let the miners control the block size. So but then you have the small blockers, which I think... they have a more like grassroots idea of who's going to control Bitcoin. It's not going to come from the corporations or the miners. It's going to come from the grassroots users it's you and me who run a BTCP server, for example. We have running our own node, and we're dictating the rules of Bitcoin by running the node and the miners. To us, they are just service providers. They just mine the blocks and they serve it to us, and we say accept or deny if it's following the rules or not, right? So that is like the core ideas of like the Bitcoin movement today and the, how Bitcoin Core was. But the big bloggers and Rodivere, they have a completely different idea about this. They think that we don't need nodes, basically, because we only need miners, and the miners should just, they can go together and they can discuss and sign some agreements that we're gonna increase the block size, and the users don't have to care because they're just gonna get this software update, and suddenly there's a new block size, and they don't know because. And they can't have any say in this. So that's like the big difference. And it's very obvious to me that, of course, Bitcoin should be controlled by the people and us, the people who run nodes. And that's why Bitcoin has to stay decentralized. That's why everyone should be able to run a node if they can. And that's why the block size hasn't decreased. There hasn't been any consensus within the Bitcoin core sphere that we should increase the block size to like the crazy amounts that the big blockers are saying.
Yeah, just to add to that, my conviction, I became really convinced about Bitcoin's decentralization, that it was actually not just empty words, but a real thing, back in 2017 with this SegWit 2x hard fork was denied by the community, because the community wanted SegWit, but we didn't want the 2x. And all the big players, like above 95% of them, I think, that got together in some, you know, evil conglomerate meeting in New York, and they decided that okay, we will push SegWit through, and then we will increase the block size. And the users just stopped it by signaling that we won't fall for this. And this is like, some people claim that is that showed me that generation of Bitcoin's users were vigilant enough to fight this, but it doesn't mean that we're safe forever. We need to stay this way in order to secure Bitcoin. Like if we become complacent, then we lose the whole thing, because Bitcoin is not backed by energy. It's backed by us and like what yes. we choose yeah. to do.
Absolutely. I mean, many people call the USF soft fork like the Bitcoin Liberation Day or something, like the Independence Day, because that's when we fought this massive attack. Like you said, 2x was like an agreement of between all the Bitcoin companies, like the big businesses, like the Roger Ver companies and the miners, that all are going to do this. And yet Bitcoin was able to resist this. And the most ridiculous part of the book is that Roger seeing this all backwards. He's seeing that this was consensus, that the industry had reached the consensus, but the Bitcoin core has been hijacked by this forces, and he's using like absurd conspiracy theories to draw this conclusion that it got hijacked by bankers and the Bilderberg to control Bitcoin, to kill Bitcoin. And so that's why the future of Bitcoin now lives within Bitcoin Cash. So that's why he's still promoting Bitcoin Cash instead as the true Bitcoin. And I mean, at one point it's like ridiculous and hilarious to read this perspective. But then on the other hand, you have to remind that it was like the biggest attack against Bitcoin that we ever had. So we shouldn't forgive that guy, invite him to podcast and stuff to promote his agenda, because he hasn't changed his mind a single bit. He just continues to promote his Bitcoin Cash and all that stuff.
That's so weird, though. He must have lost a lot of money doing this
yes.
thing.
Or, oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. He talks about how many millions he invested in Bitcoin Cash development and stuff, because he sees this as a true Bitcoin. So actually, I think he's not deliberately trying to scam. He's just, he truly believes his idea that he is part of the Bitcoin consensus, and Bitcoin Cash is like the real Bitcoin, and Bitcoin, the Bitcoin that we think is Bitcoin has been hijacked.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know what to say.
He doesn't believe in free markets then, apparently.
Well, it's very funny. He says that because Bitcoin I mean, he's even citing Austrian economics in the book and claiming that Bitcoin cannot have a value because it doesn't have a use case anymore when the fees are so high. That's why Bitcoin Cash definitely gonna pass Bitcoin as soon as people realize that Bitcoin Cash is store of value and utility with low fee. Then if he only spread this message, then people will wake up and realize, oh yes, now I know. Bitcoin is high fee and has no utility, so I have to switch to Bitcoin Cash, basically. I think that's the whole sum of the book. That's why he's shilling the book now and trying to wake people up again.
So he doesn't understand.
But I think the funny thing is that no people today, like no new people joining the space today, they have no idea what Bitcoin Cash is. It's like a long forgotten failed fork of Bitcoin, one of many. So
yeah, but that's why he might be able to fool a whole new batch of people.
Yeah,
right?
I'm not so sure about that because I mean, if you read this book as a newcomer, I think the people that are giving this book a high review are already like Roger Ver fans and big blockers. Because if you read this book as just coming out, I'm trying to imagine reading this book, and it seems very ridiculous. A lot of the stuff.
Do you think he has a chance of re-onboarding the BSV people? I mean, yeah. So the Bitcoin Cash itself had a hard fork where the fake Toshi fans went to Bitcoin Satoshi's vision.
I mean, according to Veer, Bitcoin got hijacked at least 3 times. So they forked 3 times in total. First, they had to fork from Bitcoin Core to Bitcoin Cash because Bitcoin Core got hijacked. And then it got hijacked by Craig Wright, so they had to fork it again. And then it got hijacked by the Bitcoin Cash lead developer that tried to add a dev tax to himself. So they had to fork again into 2 different versions that were called Bitcoin ABC and Bitcoin Node. So today, Bitcoin Cash is like the third or fork or something like that. Which is just, when you read this, it just seems like absurd. You realize that this is not how Bitcoin is supposed to work. Just splitting all the time as soon as you have some change of ideas.
No, it's Roger coin through and through, right? If it doesn't fit with Roger's point of view, then he forks it off and makes a new one. So
yeah, I don't understand how they're thinking. I mean, the whole point of I saw someone made a good point to my tweets, right, is that one of the biggest feature of Bitcoin is that it's resistant to change. That's like huge. That's if someone, a huge power, even like this New York agreement with 50 companies signing and all the mining pools, they want this change, but Bitcoin is resistant to change, so they couldn't change it. But if the grassroots usage of Bitcoin wants to change, then it actually is possible. But like you said, then like we are the Bitcoin consensus rules. It's all the users you have to convince that this change is worth it. So, and it takes a lot of time as a lot of people get frustrated by, but it takes years and years to get a change into Bitcoin. And it has to be have most upsides to like decentralization, privacy, and all this stuff, and no downs and barely any downsides. Then it may be can get merged into Bitcoin after like 5 years. So it's very hard. And it seems to get harder and harder each year to get changes into Bitcoin, which is only good. Because I think everyone wants to protect Bitcoin from change because we don't want it to get actually hijacked or changed for the worse by some ideas from someone in our next generation that thinks inflation is good or something. Like it could happen, right? So that's why I think it's good that Bitcoin is getting slowly towards solidifying. And in the end, it might not be able to change. We could just shut down the Bitcoin Core repo or something. And then everything that will be built on just side layers instead. I think that would be better. Because then you keep the 21 million limit and the decentralized network.
So would you call yourself an ossification maximalist then?
Not really. I don't want to ossify. I still think there's a lot of changes to be done into the consensus rules. I mean, there are even bugs right now in Bitcoin that will make the chain stop working in like 150 years or something. So I don't quite remember exactly which year, but it's like an integer overflow bug with a date or something. So it's not yet patched. I mean, the sort of stuff like this that has to be patched. And also, as I mentioned before, I still think we need the covenants soft forked into Bitcoin. And I also want more use of Schnorr signatures. We can use like the cross input, like join multiple input signatures into one to optimize the block space even more, and make it cheaper to do coin joins, private transactions. And I think the Human Rights Foundation was just now, like a week ago, they wanted to fund the development of cross signature input aggregation development to make this possible, make this happen into Bitcoin. So yeah, there's still stuff being worked on that definitely would need. But I mean, it was, when did we have Taproot? I think it was 2021. So it was 3 years since we activated the last soft fork, and we still don't have any plan for the next one yet. So you see how slow we are moving.
If we rewind the clock back to 2017 again, there was something called ASIC Boost. That was a patented way of using Bitcoin miners that made them like 10% more efficient than the competing miners, right? And there was like, I don't know if this patent was ever used, actually used, or if it was just threatened to be used, and if like this is why the miners were so against SegWit, because SegWit would deny them to use this thing. What do you remember?
I mean, Bitmain has been for a long time being the biggest miners, because they are the manufacturer of miners in China, and they are also basically using their best miners for themselves to mine, and then they're selling the generation before to everyone all around the world. So they're keeping like the best one for themselves. And I don't know the details on how ASIC Boost worked or if it actually was in use, but there was a big talk about how Bitmain is using this ASIC Boost to have a huge advantage with hashing power, and the SegWit soft fork was actually fixed that somehow. I don't know how, but for some reason ASIC Boost would stop working with SegWit. So yeah, so that was speculated as one of the reasons why they were against SegWit. But again, they signed the agreement to fork Bitcoin into SegWit 2x, which means activate SegWit and then do a block size increase. So I don't know.
There's a lot for historians to dive into.
If you want to read about this, there's a good book called The Block Size War.
Yeah, that I think that it's slightly skewed, that book. Like the perspective is not entirely, like, it's from a guy it's seemingly still, you know, indecisive of what what he wanted in terms of large or small blocks.
I think he tried to make an outside perspective, like a guy just following the events and trying to make it as objective as possible. But I think it shines through that the big blockers argument didn't hold water. So I think I felt that it was more leaning towards the small blocker side.
Yeah, I think he could have been harsher.
Well, I think it was it's a good book to see like the both sides and the argument. And I think for me, it was obvious when I'm reading this that the small blockers were right in the debate.
We're now partnered with the Bitcoin Advisor, your best choice for collaborative multi-sig custody. The Bitcoin Advisor guides you every step of the way, from taking self-custody of your Bitcoin to securing it in their multi-sig vaults. Estate planning and inheritance is built in, so your loved ones can have peace of mind.
And you know what the best part is? Me and Luke are Bitcoin Advisors, so you can contact us. We can advise you about Bitcoin and Bitcoin custody, how to make custard, anything really. We're Bitcoin Advisors.
So visit us at thebitcoinadvisor.com/freedom or send us a DM or email to get started.
Contact us within 2 weeks and we'll throw in a free set of steak knives. Maybe.
The show is also sponsored by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network where you can stack friends who stack sats. Make local connections and find all the nearby meetups, see what's going on in your area, and connect with Bitcoiners around you. And now, with a brand new merchant section, it's easier than ever to find and connect with local businesses that accept Bitcoin.
The best part about Orange Pill App is that you know that it's high signal because you're paying for Orange Pill App, and so is everyone else. There are no Asian ladies asking you how your trade is going on Orange Pill App, because it's not a trading app. It's a dating app. Is it a dating app?
So download the Orange Pill App on Apple or Android, send us a DM, and start building your local network of Bitcoiners.
So maybe to return back to the present a little bit, what is it that Mempool is working on these days?
We have been working a lot towards our the business model of the Mempool Space company, which is the accelerator service. So a lot of the stuff that we've been developing has been towards that end. And you can see even now, if you go to the website, if you go to an unconfirmed transactions, there's a button called Accelerate, and you can click there and you can see the fee breakdown. But the service is still not launched, so you can only sign up on the waitlist. And then we have improved a lot, when it comes to viewing the mempool, like with the filters, like I explained before, you can see what's data, what's the coin join and consolidation. You can filter for a lot of stuff, and it's all ties down to seeing what transactions has been accelerated as well as stuff like that.
Is there an educational video somewhere mempool.space for dummies where you show all the features and
not an official one. There are people that have been doing guided videos on YouTube and stuff, but we keep adding a lot of tiny features everywhere now and then, and I think most of the advanced users that are using the website every day, they notice, but most people are probably never gonna need to use those features. But it's you can do a detailed dive into the mempool and filter by various stuff. We just added that you can filter by age, for example, so then you see different transactions in different fading depending on their age.
I mean, I love it. I learned something new. I wouldn't say maybe not every time I use the site, but it's a very, you can learn a lot from just exploring this site and clicking on stuff.
I know, and I've seen from so many people how they discovered a lot of features of Bitcoin by just browsing around on the website, because we're visualizing and showing all these features that didn't exist before. For example, one thing we have is that if you go to block zero, the Genesis block, or one of the first few blocks, you see that when the coins were mined, addresses didn't exist. And this is something that we show correctly on Mempool Space, but most other block explorers show it wrongly. They show with addresses, but the addresses didn't exist back in 2010 and 2009 when Bitcoin was launched. So it was only paid to public keys that you have to connect to someone's node via IP, then you can make a transaction. So, I mean, it's a bit just one example of stuff that you can notice when you click around, because people ask us sometimes why does it look like this? And it's because this and this. So you can learn a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the whole feature set is interesting here, and I run a self-hosted mempool on my node, and so the mempool.space is sort of the official version, right? It's Wiz's mempool officially, something like that. I at least I've heard it referred to as that, right?
Yeah, it's our mempool. It's from our data centers. But yes, I'm glad you're running your own mempool and you can validate the transaction yourself. And I think that's part of the new kind of Bitcoin culture and the new Bitcoin companies from since 2017, that you have people before you had BitPay, for example, I want to take over Bitcoin. But now you have BTC Pay Server instead, where you run your own node and you can accept payments yourself without a third party. And with Mempool, you can run your own explorers. You don't have to go to blockchain.com or something to check your transaction and trust them. Then you can run it yourself, because we are an open source product. And I think that's the whole ethos of Bitcoin, right? That you can self-host everything yourself. So I really like this new direction Bitcoin took after the war of 17.
Absolutely. That's the direction we need to go in.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the way I use it is that my node never is exactly the same thing as the mempool.space node. Just from, I don't know, not exactly seeing the same mix of transactions or even now when there are so many transactions in the mempool, because that's an issue, right? Like with the current amount of transactions currently in the mempool, well over
200,000.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's a lot to be able to keep up, right? Most nodes aren't keeping that many.
Yeah, but we are using basically unlimited nodes, so we can keep all the transactions, and we also disabled the timeout, so we keep all transactions until they get confirmed. For now, we'll see what we do in the future. Maybe I have to start deleting old stuff, but most home node runners are going to have the default, which is like 300 megabyte limit, I think. So when you run mempool locally, you're going to have much less transactions. It will basically filter out the lowest fees. So I think all the 1 cent per rebyte transactions that have been laying around there, taking hundreds of megabytes, they don't show up on your local node.
Yeah, does this theoretically mean that since mempool is keeping basically everything around, that nothing is going to really age out of the system at this point? Like even if it's someone's got a 1 sat per vbyte transaction that hasn't confirmed in well over 6 months, it's still kicking around there on mempool. Therefore, it's
going, because we don't want people to look up their transaction and it says not found. We want to have all the transactions.
So if I get this right, like the thing you talked about before by boosting, it's like a child pays for parent or something like that, right? Or replaced by fee, or what is it? Or is it just off band?
It's completely off band.
Okay.
We are sitting between the users and the mining pools, basically. So that is the idea. And this is something that's been very popular recent years. Like a lot of mining pools, they have own accelerator pages now. I think at least 3 mining pools have their own accelerator services that are a bit so if you look at certain blocks, you can see there's always like a bunch of like 10% of the block is like these off band accelerated transactions or fee bump transactions, but we are going to what we built is a transaction off band service that is fully public and fully auditable. So you can see on mempool space which transactions that are being fee bumped, and in the blocks you can see, you can go to a node block and you can see which have been fee bumped. You can see how much extra fee they paid off band. Yeah, I mean the basic idea is that you open a transaction that's unconfirmed and the fee is too low to be confirmed in 3 times. So you want to pay for getting it accelerated off band. So you click the accelerate button and then you get the fee breakdown that you can see right now. That is how far you can go right now, because you can't use the service just yet. We're just running like in beta, some beta testing right now.
Okay. So the real question in here that I wanted to ask is like,
are you attacking Bitcoin?
Are you attacking Bitcoin? Exactly. Like, yeah. And of course you're going to say,
I know it's very controversial.
Can you steel man your arguments, please?
Yeah, I know. I know it's very controversial. And I've been like finding myself, if this is really a good thing. But I think there are a lot of legitimate use cases where people's transactions are stuck and there's no way to RBF. There's no way to CPFB. And they reach out to us and say, please, can you help me confirm my transaction? And there's no way, because the protocol, how it works right now, is that you can't accelerate all kinds of transactions. And a very common one are Lightning force closures by C-Lightning or something like that. So it's like they force close a transaction with 2 sats per vbyte and it's stuck in the mempool and the node is just locking up all this capital. And so if you could just click a button and do this off band, that would actually provide a help for service for these people. So that makes me feel that it's a good service. And then the second thing is that it's already happening, and it's already been happening for a long time, but it's all opaque behind closed doors. And people are sending emails and they're writing on Twitter with the mining pools, like, you know, like the, I don't know if you remember the 4 megabyte block that the UDI mined or something. He just DM'd on Twitter some mining pool, and he sent this transaction, and he paid like some fee, and you don't know what he paid, and you didn't see it in a mempool. It just showed up, right? So there's a lot of this kind of stuff that's happening right now that is you don't know what's going on. So it's called, we call it dark mempools. So this is a growing phenomenon, which is a bit scary. It's basically these dark mempools where people are doing the trading of Bitcoin transactions, and it's also pushed a lot by the ordinals, the people who wants to do off-band transaction stuff. And so what we are doing is trying to compete, and we're doing like a 10x much better service that is open and transparent and everyone can validate. And we even make it possible that even if you host your own node, you can audit and see the what transaction has been accelerated. So basically, it's not great that we have to resort to this off-band system, but it's inevitable, as Bitcoin Core, as it works today, is not going to change so that you can just fee bump any transaction, because this doesn't work. Like, if you have a stuck transaction that already paid all its all its inputs in the outputs, there's no way of bumping the fee, and there's no way to, like, maybe you're sending from one exchange to another. There's no way of bumping the fee because you can't use RBF, because you don't control the private keys. So there's like all these cases where you have stuck transactions and you can only resort to off-band right now. So that's why we're providing a solution. So that is, and for us, it's a good business model that can fund the company and the project, the open source project that build out all these, all the great features. So we're just sitting and coding great features and publish it all open source all day long. But we also have some funding from Bitcoin investors that in the future want to have some revenue. And I think the transactional acceleration system is one very such good service that we can use, because we don't want banner ads. We don't sell data. Like, it's very hard to monetize in many ways.
And do you see competitors to yourselves in the future? I mean, your competitors now are the pools themselves, right? And their own systems. But do you think there will be a competitor in the transparency thing?
It might be, but I mean, the benefit we have is that we have a lot of we have a lot of users that are coming to the site because they want to track a transaction or see why it's stuck. So we have a lot of the demand right now. So people have they go to the website from a wallet, for example, when they check, why isn't my transaction confirmed in one day? And they go to the website, and if they see an accelerate button and they can pay a Lightning invoice, they click pay $10 and then it gets accelerated and confirmed in the next block. That is how we can catch more users than competitors, I think.
Yeah. So, okay, let's do a specific example here. If you have a coin join with 200 participants and it's stuck, then it becomes a bit more tricky, right? Because that's a lot more fees.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's probably not going to be viable to accelerate. It might cost $1,000 in a fiat value to accelerate, because it's so huge. If it's like a big transaction in the mempool, because you have to pay to, as you would increase the fee of the transaction.
So what could you do about that? I guess nothing. Just wait and hope for the best, and hope for people to.
Yeah, maybe someone in the CoinJoin made a huge $1 million CoinJoin wash, and he feels it's necessary. It's economically viable to accelerate the CoinJoin. I don't know.
All right. Yeah. At least these payments, because you only accept Bitcoin, I presume. For these, or you plan to, because you haven't launched the thing yet. But
yeah, we care mostly about Bitcoin. Yeah.
Mostly,
we want to have Bitcoin. That's the goal. All right. So if I can decide, we will accept Bitcoin, Lightning, over Liquid, and all kinds of way you can pay privately on Bitcoin.
Okay, but the pools may take like a briefcase full of dollars or something. I guess your competitors, that is, like Udi's transaction, for instance, he might have just given a briefcase full of dollars to some important person, or showed him pictures of him having sex with someone he shouldn't have had sex with or something. I mean, there are many ways of paying for stuff.
Yeah, but we want to have the most affordable way, so...
And transparent.
Yeah, that's the idea.
All right, great. Luke, what comes to your mind here?
Well, I think this has been a good chat. We've had a bit of history, a bit of current state. So I'll just throw it right back at you, Simon. Is there anything else you wanted to bring up? Or if there isn't anything else on your mind, where can our listeners, where would you like to direct our listeners to?
You can go to mempool.space and, you can, if you have building a home node like Umbrella or something, you should install the Mempool app, the open source app, and self-host yourself. So when you look up transactions, it's going to be all private data straight from your node. So I encourage everyone to do that. And you can follow me on Twitter at SoftSimon. You should also follow at Mononautical. Mononaut is our mempool rockstar developer. He tweets almost every day about all the shenanigans going on in the mempool in a very technical manner. And so that I recommend.
That account is fantastic. We were just talking about that the other day and like how much of Mononaut bad boys we are. Simon, thank you very much for this conversation. This has been great, educational, and fantastic in general. And don't listen to Roger Ver or any of his lackeys for that matter. And don't trust them when they say they're very sorry that they promote the fake Toshi.
They're not sorry. I don't think they're sorry at all.
They're just trying to fool you again. So don't give them the benefit of the doubt. Listen to real stupidity beats artificial intelligence every time. And keep on rocking. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot, Simon. This has been the Freedom Footprint Show. Thanks for listening.